Hello and welcome to the Ace Pod 1.12, presented by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. I am your host, Ace Hambender. And this week, I'm flying solo once again. Hoops preview stuff is kind of messed with my schedule a little bit, so this is a day later than I was hoping, but we're here, and coming off a very enjoyable victory over Notre Dame as well. So this is a more fun, less existentially sad, crushing mail pod than most of the recent ones, which I'm very happy about. And first, before getting to your questions, I have to cover Brett McMurphy of Stadium. I think that's how you refer to that outlet. Watchstadium.com. Managed to get a list of the favorite musical artist of every single FBS head coach and all of the 10 conference commissioners as well. It is a remarkable document. And pretty standard college football coach fashion, most of the stuff is like, modern mainstream country that I don't really listen to, or what we've been discussing on the Slack chat is now basically dad rap, like Jay-Z. That was James Franklin's choice. A lot of dad rock as well, which should surprise nobody. It was very, very football coach list, but there were some fun kind of outliers. First, for all the country stuff, I have to shout out NC State's Dave Doran for going with Merle Haggard. That is an extremely strong choice. Not going to win you a lot of recruits' hearts with that necessarily, but I enjoy it. That stuff's great. I have to continue with Michigan. Jim Harbaugh. I got to this list before anybody else in the AMCO blog Slack chat and asked them to try to guess what Harbaugh's choice was, even warning them that it was not going to be what they expected. And after several guesses of the relatively standard dad rock type stuff, I spotted people Bob. And got Bob Seger and Bob Dylan guessed incorrect on both counts. It is Bob Marley. That was Jim Harbaugh's answer, and I have not been able to stop thinking about it since he has answered that. I have many, many questions, starting with, is he more of a, like, laid-back Kaya Bob Marley, or is he, you know, a more, like, revolutionary, like, Exodus Bob Marley, burning that type of era? Is he familiar with, like, the Jamaican versions of the recordings, which for, especially, like, Concrete Jungle, is way more stripped down and really, really good than the somewhat overproduced versions they put out in the United States? If you're looking on, like, Apple Music, hit up the deluxe versions of Bob Marley stuff. Strongly recommended. One question that this absolutely does not bring up is, does Jim Harbaugh smoke weed? No. We have all seen Jim Harbaugh. That man does not smoke weed. So, but still, what an incredible, completely out of left field answer. I want to know his favorite album, his top five songs. It just if he ever managed to catch a live show, I want to know so much. I want to know so much. When did he start listening? So many questions. So many questions. We will probably never get any of them answered. But if any media members who go to press conferences are listening to this, please ask all of them. Ed Orgeron at LSU answered Creedence Clearwater Revival, which has now rocketed to the top of my list in terms of karaoke performances I want to hear. I need to hear Ed Orgeron doing John Fogerty. Jay Hobson, former Michigan assistant coach under Rich Rodriguez and also the first white head coach in SWAC history, answered Meatloaf, which is amazing given the previous fact. In kind of a similar vein, but flipped a bit, Nevada's Jay Norvell, who is 56 years old from Madison, Wisconsin, and definitely white, answered Harold Melvin in the Blue Notes. So that was pretty fantastic. And now I also want to hear his feelings about Teddy Pendergrass and the before and after era. Les Miles answered 21 Savage, which is like the only, he's the only coach in the country who can say a rapper who like is too young for me and have me not entirely sure whether he's pandering to recruits. It's Les Miles. I have no idea. The most perfect football coach answer was Marshall's Doc Holliday, saying that he does not have a favorite musical act. He does not have time for that. He is game planning. He is in the film room. He has no time for music. Football coaches are insane. But if there is something more perfect than that, it is the thing that Brian noted on Twitter, which is David Shaw picking Sade, which is practically ambient music, as his favorite. I imagine that is being piped into his headset, and that's why he spaces out on critical in-game decisions. I'll wrap this up because I'm probably boring a lot of you, but the least surprising thing to me on that list, Pat Narduzzi picking AC/DC. The most surprising thing on that list, Jim freaking McElwain picking Earth, Wind, and Fire. I really want to know if he knows any other song other than September. Once again, I don't think we're going to get answers to these really important questions, but let's move on to your emails. First one is from Doug. So, was that team we saw Saturday night in the Big House one that was finally hitting its stride, living up to expectations, etc., or one that just happened to play really well on a rainy night in October? Put another way, can we now expect them to more or less hang with OSU this year? I think those are two different questions. this is a team that definitely hit its stride in a way on Saturday against Notre Dame. That we haven't seen so far this year. The play calling seemed to click in a way that hadn't so far. The run game was going. I don't want to draw too much out of a game where throwing the football was a real bad idea for the most part. But they did manage to get some shots downfield, so that still was nice. And, I am a person who likes to, you know, have some body of evidence built up, so it would be very nice to get another performance like that, even if it's just blasting Maryland this weekend. I can now expect them once again. I now feel so much better about the Michigan State game than I did before, and less worried about a potential disaster against Indiana. But Ohio State, you know, maybe this draws the margin back in a little bit, but there is still a significant gap between those two teams right now. And just going to have to see more before I think Michigan has a good chance of hanging with them. There's always a chance they can hang with them. We remember Devin Gardner almost beating them. But I was very happy about the Notre Dame game. It didn't move the needle too much for me on the Ohio State game. It did for the rest of the schedule. So, that's definitely not nothing considering how things were looking at about halftime of the Penn State game. Next question. A little hot takey here, but I hear a lot of people talking about how, quote, Harbaugh was back, unquote, Saturday night. Opinion, is Harbaugh back? Was he never really gone? Or is his demeanor a reflection of what he's seeing on the field and thereby influenced by events as they occur? I'm torn, but lean toward the last scenario. Tom. I didn't really have any thoughts one way or the other about that, either watching the game live or afterwards. It just seemed like they maybe had the camera on him more often than they have recently. But most of what I saw from him in terms of being demonstrative was, some justifiable yelling at the refs after that defensive pass interference. It didn't come close to past Harbaugh blowups when I used to be able to populate an entire summer GIF tournament with one season's worth of him getting angry. And he was really happy after one of the touchdowns. I think that was a natural reaction to what happened on the field. I don't think I read as much into Harbaugh's sideline body language as a lot of people do. I mean, there was a rule change. Like, Harbaugh got hit with a flag in a really important game. I think part of that's just how he has chosen to be, and maybe perhaps him getting a little more mellow as he ages. I don't think that is what's impacting what's happening on the football field. So he was never really gone, I guess. And also his demeanor is a reflection of what he's seeing on the field. I think both of those are answers. But I don't think we're going to get, full blown ripping off clothing, throwing his headset Harbaugh again, just because of that gets you a 15-yard flag. And he's not going to hurt his team to try to influence the officiating. Next question is from Mike. Any feeling on if what happened with the progression of this year's team will make it more or less likely that Collins/DPJ/Black return? I feel like Collins is NFL ready and will likely go. 2 weeks ago, I felt like DPJ might leave out of frustration, but maybe now might stay for the opportunity to showcase himself next year. I don't love reading too much into, like, directly from on-field play to, or like statistical performance. On-field play obviously matters. And then that translating to draft stock, especially as you get closer to draft time and you're not, and what we're working off of is not just what Kuiper and McShay are hearing very early when teams haven't necessarily looked too strongly at guys yet. Or just the opinions of, amateur draft nicks or, whatever we've got at this stage. Scouts are going to get a lot more information going forward. They're going to pour over film. They're definitely going to look at Michigan film. And they're going to be able to pick out that, like, Nico Collins is an NFL-level receiver, regardless of whether his statistical production is up there with other guys who will be heading into the draft. That very well might be the same with Donovan Peoples-Jones. He's a remarkable athlete. He makes some really impressive catches. He's also a guy who might, I mean, you know, he was a really academically minded guy. He might be a guy who graduates in 3 years anyway. I don't know. I'm not up on the academic progress of the entire roster. But I have to assume Tariq Black returns unless he really breaks out towards the end of the season, because he's going to need to get to put together a full year where he's more of a featured guy, I think, for NFL people to be convinced that, he's past his foot injuries and is worth using a solid draft pick on. But with everybody else, these decisions come down to so much more than just what stats you're putting up and even, how you necessarily feel about the coaching staff you have and the offense you're in. There's just a lot that goes into this. So I don't love making guesses early. We didn't necessarily see, like, Willie Henry leaving early. These are things, they're difficult to predict. Taylor Lewan stayed. You can go all over the place when it's not, something kind of blindingly obvious, like a Jabril Peppers situation. Up next is a question from Daniel. After seeing flashes from guys like Dax Hill and Mike Sainristil still, how much more do you think we see guys like that on the field down the stretch? I feel like Dax has to be really close to unseating Hawkins, and I'd love to see more of Sainristil still in the slot. I have to disagree about Dax unseating Brad Hawkins. First of all, I thought Hawkins has played pretty well this week after a rough Penn State game. We'll see how the grades unfold, but I thought he was very good at aggressively filling running lanes and didn't see too much opening up on the back end that seemed to be on him. And also Michigan, I think the way that they're going to work in Dax Hill is that they will use him in the slot more often. They may go to less of that, rotating three cornerbacks, use him more. He had been used primarily in the kind of Rushman package that Michigan has, with the four defensive ends comprising the defensive line. I think, we've seen his ability to cover crossing routes to really close down quickly in the run game and on receivers in man-to-man coverage. If he's more comfortable in the zone coverages that Michigan is running, then hopefully we get to see more of him in a nickel role. I think he's the guy who's closest to having a really large role compared to what he's got right now. Samer still, I think they'll work him in a little bit. The receivers are just, I think, too good to get a ton of usage out of him. You know, Ronnie Bell's been very good. You've got DPJ and Black and Collins. So just only so many snaps to go around. I like St. Ristol's potential. It just might be an issue of having to wait to get your opportunity there, especially since down the stretch, Michigan's playing some pretty good teams. So they're not going to get a chance to showcase like they did at the end of the Notre Dame game, which is a fun thing to say. Next question is from Jason B., which means I need to answer it. With Michigan pulling out of the UCLA contract, man, that was a bummer. Who would you prefer to see us play non-conference? My dream is a home-and-home with LSU while I'm still young enough to survive the trip. Jason, that one would be extremely high on my list. I'm also very bummed. I don't know whether they've already canceled it or whether there was just a rumor that it was going to be canceled. I should probably have pulled up the schedule, but it's too late now. But going out to the University of Washington would be awesome, just for the, like, tailgating on a boat experience. That seems cool, and I'm not even necessarily a boat type of person. But that would be very fun, at least when it happens, when it's warm enough out, that you know, early September for that one. That one would be really great. I would love to get down to a lot of SEC country. It'd be cool to see the Grove at Ole Miss. I have been to Tuscaloosa multiple times, but I've not been to a football game there. Things haven't timed up right. I don't know if I want Michigan to play Alabama again, or if they do, I would like them to set it far enough in the future that Nick Saban will be gone. But that would be cool. Maybe you can split the difference and do Auburn. And Texas would be very high on the list for me. It'd be cool to go to Austin. These are just kind of similar fan bases, it feels like. I would like to see those fan bases collide. I think it would go a lot better than the Ohio State-Texas home-and-home did, however many years ago that was, when Texas fans were a little appalled by what they ran into in Columbus. So that's my top-of-the-head list. I'm sure that people have a lot more suggestions that I will be angry that I didn't think of myself. Next one is from Alex. My dad and I were arguing over the impact of the California law that passed and its future repercussions on the college football landscape. This is the one about player rights for those people, players being able to profit off their name and likeness for people who haven't kept up. I made the case that Michigan stands to benefit more than almost any other school. Do you agree with me? Why or why not? For two reasons. One, money, we have a lot. Two, the location of our influence, wealthy areas on the coast, which could provide brand recognition, influential connections, etc., where players could see their likeness / brand building. I think other schools have the abstract money amount, but not the level of connection / building brand that we could sell. Yeah, I think Michigan stands to benefit almost more than any other school in the country in terms of putting things above board. The athletic department has a crap ton of money. They've got, when you're talking about, because I think what we're talking about here is, you know, you're basically doing what boosters are already doing to a certain extent, to a great extent, by having largely local businessmen, I think is what would be the case at most places, giving money to players to, you know, do commercials, whatever. And, I mean, first of all, I think Ann Arbor would do a great job of that. There's also the fact that Michigan has the largest alumni base in the country, as the university absolutely loves to remind you. So there's just, and, you know, a very successful alumni base. You know, there would be a ton of money both within the athletic department and outside of the athletic department to throw around. I think the farther they go in turn down the road of paying players not just with name and likeness stuff, which is kind of a nice way to get schools off the hook, even though I think we're heading the direction of players being acknowledged as full-blown employees. This is work, and a lot of people are making a lot of money off of this business, except the people putting their bodies on the line. So I think, you know, with the resources that Michigan has, the more you go down, pay players directly as employees of the university, anything that they can do to support the athletes, I think gives an advantage to Michigan given their resources. And yeah, I think it's both the right thing to do for, you know, moral reasons, and it'd also be nice to, for Michigan. Finishing off the email section with a hoops question from Daniel. Am I wrong to think that the Franz Wagner injury, while obviously bad in the short term, will benefit us in the long term? Maybe we'll be able to find another scorer or shooter that would have been buried on the depth chart with Wagner out there. If we can get someone to emerge and give us some points, it would set up nicely for us when Wagner comes back. Or maybe we don't find that and we realize that we have to bubble wrap the starting five for the whole season. Either way, knowing is better. I do agree with that to a certain extent. It's tough because you got a first-year coach and a true freshman who's expected to be maybe the focal point of the offense, certainly a focal point of the offense. Obviously, a lot of things are going to run through or off of the Xavier Simpson-John Teske pick and roll. But I expected Wagner to be a major contributor now that those wing spots are open. And he was going to fill minutes at pretty much any spot where Michigan potentially had a problem. So now players are going to be able to work through that. And hopefully we'll be able to find someone, whether it's Adrian Nunez or Cole Bajima or David DeJulius, who seems to be the leading candidate thus far. Although Nunez has also gotten starting time in the recent scrimmages. So we'll see. I do think there are certainly some benefits. I don't think they outweigh the negatives, obviously. But as long as Wagner comes back with enough time to, you know, be in form for Big Ten play, then there are definitely some ways where this could help Juwan Howard figure out his rotation in a way that would have been difficult if Wagner was absorbing 30 minutes, 35 minutes a game a lot of nights. So there is a benefit to that. And with that, we're going to take a quick break and then hit your Twitter questions.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email jason@blankenshiplawyer.com.
The image of Jim Harbaugh just sitting back and listening to that is going to sustain me for a long time. All right, we are on to your Twitter questions. My favorite right off the top is from at Lord Razor, who asks, the Notre Dame game was fun on some level, but how can the Michigan fan base derive any joy from it, considering the heat death of the galaxy is getting nearer all the time? You know, it's really incredible that any of us do it, and congratulations to us all. I think we should applaud ourselves. I don't really have anything more to add. Obviously it was fun, while we are getting close to the heat death of the universe, it was nice to be able to enjoy some football again. In a slightly more serious question, from @Tuba1060, which is where all the serious questions come from, do you think the offense's progress from this week and the second half of Penn State is due to sustainable systemic change, or do we think it's simply a matter of running different stuff, and now that it's on tape this season, teams will have it downloaded and we can crawl back into the B-pone? And by teams, I mean OSU. I think there was sustainable change there in terms of they really did go back to a lot of last year's running game. Last year's running game had really good parts that built off of each other. The passing game has been, in that game, was incorporated in a way that made sense. A lot of the stuff was play action. So it took a while, but I liked the way the offense looked in the last six quarters. So that's really something. And, you know, teams will have it scouted, but, you know, there's only so much that you can do in terms of preparing for, like, yeah, if Michigan gets good at both pin and pull and traps and whams, those plays function off of each other. They're nice counters to each other. So I expect Ohio State to be the toughest test for the offense's progress, but I do think that this progress made Ohio State's job more difficult, and that's a big step, especially compared to where they were at. Okay, if Lloyd Razor's question was not my favorite, it is this one from @DrGarbs. If nobody's asked, and nobody did, so thank you so much for doing so, can you come up with the perfect Biodome settings for 1. Home opener tomato can, 2. Core rivals, we know Notre Dame already, 3. Obligatory service academies, 4. Bowl game versus reasonable Power 5 opponent, assume by then that Michigan engineers have created portable dome technology. Have to assume swirling winds, perfect sunshine, sweltering heat, earthquakes, emergency lightning strike, all on the table. By all means. So for people who have missed it, this is building off of the Fuego Box hot take segment from the MGO podcast, in which I suggested that Michigan use their tremendous scientific might and funding to build a biodome over Michigan Stadium so that we can control weather for games. I'm on board. I'm taking this totally seriously, as y'all can tell. And, you know, Brian's protestations were heard and largely dismissed. You can put a gate in the biodome. People can get in and out. You know, we're not stupid. As somebody pointed out on Twitter, and I apologize for not having this pulled up, the Truman Show provided a very good example of what this can be and what we're really going for here, which is micro control, because I want this to be like you can unleash a hellstorm directly over the field, and the fans, some of whom are whiny like Brian, will be perfectly dry and happy and just observing the storm from the edge, which I have to imagine would actually be very cool. This is why we really fund the heck out of this. This is why we're Michigan. So to go in order, for the home opener tomato can, you know, perfect sunshine is fine for that. You want to get those, like, you know, early season perfect blue sky shots, that one's going to be pretty straightforward. For the core rivals, obviously you want to bring as much rain as you can for Notre Dame, because they're gonna try to throw on it no matter what. And I know they didn't have a run game last week, but I still don't think they're changing their ways. Brian Kelly is Brian Kelly. So, yeah, obviously you bring that rain down on Notre Dame. Michigan State, you do the exact opposite. Michigan State, the only thing you change from the home opener tomato can is that it is a slate gray sky, because it just has to be a slate gray sky for Michigan, Michigan State. That is the in-state rivalry of the state of Michigan, the state of slate gray skies for at least half the year. It's just too appropriate, and also the photographers love it, as I have come to learn from working with our photographers. So it helps you get the color balance right, or what. It gets you some really good shots. So makes Michigan, Michigan State look good. Does not allow Michigan State to take advantage of wildly adverse weather situations to turn what should be a comfortable victory for Michigan into a really hideous victory for Michigan State. That is their signature. We know to stay away from it. For Ohio State, you alternate. You bring the sunshine on Michigan's possessions. And on Ohio State, it is hailing. It is raining. It is snowing. It is sleeting. It is doing everything. Except it is somehow warm enough that dries up by the time Michigan gets the ball. But you need every edge. Every single edge. So the operator of the Biodome is going to need to be on point for that game. You might want to get a few people in there. But turn some of those luxury boxes into a Truman-style, you know, base of operations looking down on the field. We're going to make this happen. This is really going to happen. Next question is from Jeep and Ben. Hey, Ace, what's your best advice for following a Michigan game if you're incapable of keeping up in real time? Could be a fall wedding, travel, etc. Thanks. Love the pod. Thank you. I am the worst person to ask this, because my job involves an excuse to get out of all of these things because I have to write up the game. That said, I have been out of pocket before, not in a very long time, but I have been. There was one time in college at my cousin's wedding when I was trying to use a pretty crappy hotel internet stream to watch what I believe was the 2009 Purdue game. Whatever game Michigan lost to Purdue at home, it was not worth it. The stream was horrible, and I just gave up and followed on my phone, and I was better for it. And so my answer is that it depends on the situation, but I think in general, if there's something that's taking you away from a game, it's something worth your time. I know people will complain about weddings and whatnot, but hopefully you're going to a wedding of some people you really love and love spending time around, and hopefully it's, you know, not the Ohio State or Michigan State game. But sometimes it's unavoidable. My thing would be to, you know, maybe check in. There's kind of two strategies to it. You can try to go completely dark, and the success of that very much depends on where you live and who's around you and what kind of event you're at. One of my best friends is a teacher who lives on the West Coast, and he can text a few people ahead of time saying, I'm, you know, don't give me game updates, and he is pretty safe for being able to get back to his place, fire up the DVR, and watch the game without having it spoiled. If you can do that, awesome. I'd say go for that. A lot of situations you're not going to be able to get through without catching a score somewhere, running into another Michigan fan who does not have the same level of restraint as you do. You know, if you're at a wedding that is in Michigan, you know, people are going to know and talk about it, and it might be hard to miss. Or, you know, the other thing is just like you're also forcing yourself to break some habits that may be pretty well ingrained. Like, do you habitually check Twitter? Do you habitually pull up the ESPN app? These are some things that you might do without thinking, and suddenly your whole plan has gone to hell. So if you're in a situation where, if you're in a situation like that, I would just follow on my phone. And then if it seems like it's a game that's worth rewatching, you know, even knowing the outcome, that can actually be quite fun. And you might save yourself some time one way or the other if it turns out that it was just not a particularly worthwhile game to spend three and a half, four hours on, and you ended up doing something else with your fall Saturday. So that is my advice. And I'm not sure whether you should listen to it, because I almost never have to heed it. So take it for what it's worth. This one is from at Lofter4. What is the most feasible non-injury version of how Michigan wins the Big Ten in hoops? Obviously this starts with Michigan State being pretty disappointing, which I guess is feasible if they just don't really have anybody to emerge to replace like Matt McQuaid and Kenny Goins. They are pretty inexperienced on the wings. Maybe they have a really horrendous shooting drop off. McQuaid was their specialist gunner. So, I mean, the hope is that like they just have Michigan State has nobody break out. And Michigan, on the other hand, has pretty much everybody break out. Franz Wagner comes back both in time for Big Ten play, probably a little bit before that, so he can get things going and gel with the team before having to be thrown out there in a pretty major role. I think for Michigan to win the Big Ten, Teske and Castleton have to be like a really strong high-low combo at the four and the five. The five and the four, given the order I named them. And you're going to need, you know, to hit on Brandon Johns breaking out and at least one of DeJulius, Bajima, or Nunez being a very viable Big Ten player, rotation player right away. And then you're also going to need some incremental improvements out of Xavier Simpson, being able to threaten more to both sides, maybe develop a floater game, something other than the hook shots that can get him to keep him a threat. And I guess if we're talking for how the Michigan wins the Big Ten in hoops, it also involves Xavier Simpson probably improving a little bit as a three-point shooter. As you can probably tell, I don't think Michigan's going to win the Big Ten, barring some injury weirdness, mostly for Michigan State. But I don't think it's impossible. So there is that. Last one is from the one man zone. What's the upside of our basketball team this year? Elite Eight? Elite Eight to me would be, that would probably be the ceiling, I would say. I mean, it might even be a little bit lower than that. I think Michigan is a team that could win its first couple games in the tournament if things come together and they can make the second weekend of the tournament. Progressing much from there without getting some real luck of the tournament draw or just like an absolute on fire game from the outside, which it doesn't seem like this team is really constructed to do. I'm not sure how they push past that point necessarily. I'm worried about the level of shooting on this team. There is just a large level of uncertainty, both in terms of the roster turnover and the coaching turnover. And yeah, year one of a new coach, new system, they're definitely going to be changing the way that they run plays. They're going to run a lot more NBA stuff. And you're going to see more freelancing, but also more turnovers. You're going to see more tempo. And also we're going to see what happens on the defensive end. But there's just too many things up in the air for me to predict the upside of the team to be further than getting to the Sweet 16. And I think from there, might be pushing it a little bit. And with that, take another break, and then we're going to get to the top five rain game life hacks.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email jason@blankenshiplawyer.com.
First time we met is a favorite memory of mine. Say time changes all it pertains to, but your memory is stronger than time. I guess everything does change except what you choose to recall. There's a million good daydreams to dream on, but baby, you are my favorite memory of all.
Dave Doran, you have great taste. That's Merle Haggard, if you're wondering. Last segment of this one. One of the questions that came in was not actually a question, but our friends at Hoover Street Rag wanted to provide some game day rain game, or their favorite game day rain game life hack. And actually, I think they added a few extras. So, yeah, it was multiple life hacks. So I petitioned for a few more, and I got a few really good ones. I figured this is useful for people, albeit maybe a little bit late. I apologize if you maybe had your phone damaged because you didn't have it in a quart-sized bag. Spoiler alert. But this is useful stuff. So starting at number 5, the suggestion comes from at dfits52. Bring an extra set of clothes and shoes to leave in the car. Sounds simple. Something you could easily forget, and man, is that it is so much worse to be sopping wet in the car on the way home, in addition to being soaked for the whole game, than that amazing moment when you get to the car and you can rip off the like t-shirt that has been completely soaked through for 3 hours, even though it is buried 7 layers down, and put on something that'll at least infuse a little bit of warmth back into you. And shoes also quite critical, because waiting for shoes to dry out takes freaking forever. And especially if you're driving in a set of sopping wet shoes is just a brutal experience. And also probably a little bit unsafe. So don't do that. Bring an extra set of clothes and an extra set of shoes. This was amazing advice for me at the 2008 Notre Dame game when we went down there. And it paid off. The next one is mine, although I did have several people jump on in support of it, so I don't feel as bad for putting my own suggestion in this top 5, which is fingerless glove mittens. If you know what I'm talking about, you are on board. But those fingerless gloves are amazing, and the for when it's a little bit colder, the ones that have the mitten attachment that you can pull over the top is great for warmth. And then when you need to handle some food or go to the bathroom or use your phone, you still have the dexterity of your fingers. You can still use your fingerprint to get into your phone, all that good stuff. And, you know, provided you are putting your phone under your poncho or rain gear or something like that, or you have dunked under some sort of cover. Fingerless glove mittens are one of the most incredible inventions that we have been blessed with, and you should take advantage of them. They were something that really paid off when I was covering high school football on what tended to be some very cold sidelines while taking notes, or up in the stands, or even on top of the press box, which is where it got particularly cold. All right, number 3 is from at Steve E. Adams, with an assist from at Blue Baron Photo, a.k.a. our photographer Patrick Barron. Buy a rain suit, one size larger than you would normally wear. This is where Patrick jumped in to recommend free size, which seems to be pretty large, and he would know having to get that over a bunch of photography gear. Back to the email. Buy a rain suit one size larger than you would normally wear. That way it will fit over any winter gear you have. I have one specifically for cold Michigan games. Warmer rain, you can wear a poncho. Best $50 you'll spend, combined with waterproof boots and gloves, and you're golden. Yeah, having something that just where you can put on like a rain, like just some straight up winter gear, because no matter how like overdoing it you think it might be when you're heading in, you're going to be so glad that you decided to wear some heavy duty gear. especially if you're either at like a definitely for a night game, and especially if you're at like a 3:30 game where it starts out warm and then when the sun goes down, it is a completely different ball game. So having something that can go over a legitimate winter coat is awesome. And that free size looks like it can certainly do that. And for $50, that sounds very much worth it to get through a game. Number two is from at TrailRN610. This is another one that I did growing up, albeit with a different style bag. Drymax socks, expensive but worth it in rainy conditions. If no waterproof shoes, just use plastic grocery bags over top of your socks. Also, a compression base layer for warmth on cold, rainy days, and layer out from there. I definitely used my old running gear when I was a student. My cold weather running tights. Put those on under my jeans and various upper layers. And when I was growing up, unfortunately, we have mostly moved past this. But if you know anyone who still gets actual physical newspapers and is not using them as poop bags for their pet, those are perfect for putting over top of your socks. And I'd say sometimes even if you've got waterproof shoes, it's worth it. Like, it'll add a layer of warmth anyway. It's one more layer. It is waterproof. And then, make sure your pants, and I would recommend pants that have an elastic bottom if you can, which a lot of rain gear has. A little less fashionable if you're rocking jeans. Then you can put your pants over that and you really don't want to get your feet wet because that will really ruin a day. So that is excellent advice from Trail Nurse. And number one comes from the people who asked the question at Hoover Street. And this was a thread. So this was on Twitter, but this is lengthy. When you know it has been or is raining on game day, pack some paper towels in your jacket pocket. Then when you wipe down your seat, one, dab and absorb, don't wipe. The channels in the seats hold the water. Two, wipe the front facing of the seat and underside. This will prevent your pants from getting wet at that level. More importantly, get that underside of the front as the water creeps up from there. Admittedly, this works better at games where the rains have stopped or there was rain overnight, but yes, Michigan Stadium requires paper towels. The recycled napkins will not get it done. Also, court-size bag for your wallet, court-size bag for your phone. All extremely good advice. I used to use the paper programs that they would hand out to wipe down my seats, but that would be less effective and absorbent than actual paper towels. And this is tremendous advice in terms of one of the ways to really ruin a rain day game is to get the kind of load dumped on you in some way or another. And those see anywhere where water can kind of pool up and all of a sudden fall out is a bad thing. And yeah, if you get the bench jostled, you can get, all of a sudden the back of your legs totally soaked. At the aforementioned 2008 Notre Dame game I was at, there were two idiots sitting in front of me who weren't even rooting for a particular team, who both busted out umbrellas during the game and were completely oblivious to the fact that it was just pouring sheets of water down the back of the umbrellas directly onto the front of our legs. And I don't want to say what I contemplated at that moment, because I don't know what the statute of limitations is, but I was not happy about it. Thankfully, they did get the message to put the umbrellas away only after we showed them how soaking wet we had become. Not that I'm still mad or anything. But that is your top five rain game life hacks. That is the end of this week's podcast. It's maybe a little bit shorter this week than some recent episodes, but I really need to get back to writing the basketball preview. On that note, I'm probably either going to have a very short podcast or no podcast at all next week because I will be finishing the basketball preview. I really need to get that done. and football is still going on. So I should be back in a couple weeks once I have cranked all that out and maybe taken a day off in there at some point. But thank you for listening. Thank you to the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship for sponsoring the podcast. And thank you to Brett McMurphy for tracking down the favorite musical artist of every college head coach and athletic director. That was wonderful content. Have a great week, everybody.